Hello, and welcome to the Innovation Agency podcast. Our topic is the interface between clinicians in primary and secondary care, how colleagues can help each other in the transition of a patient from home to GP surgery to hospital and back again. We'll hear about the creation of a new protocol by Cheshire and Merseyside Health and Care Partnership. Our host is Innovation Agency Chief Executive, Dr. Phil Jennings.
Hi everybody, welcome to another of our podcasts here at the Innovation Agency. I'm Phil Jennings and I'm joined today by two clinical colleagues from the Integrated Care System. So let me start by asking each of you to introduce yourselves, starting with you, Rowan.
Hi, I'm Rowan Pritchard-James. I'm a plastic reconstructive surgeon by background, currently working as the medical director at St Helens and Knowsley on the east side of the city, but will be taking up the post as the medical director of the Cheshire Mersey Integrated Care System as it comes into life on the 1st of July.
Well, welcome to the Innovation Agency. And Jonathan?
Good afternoon. Thanks, Phil. So my name is Jonathan Griffiths. I'm a GP in Cheshire. And I've been working as the GP advisor to the Cheshire Merseyside at ICS.
So we're closely approaching the 1st of July, so the ICS will become a statutory body. So it might be good to hear what's in your inbox at the moment, and then maybe how you see things panning out over the next 12 months. Maybe I'll ask you both that question. So again, starting with you, Rowan.
Yeah, so my inbox is interesting because I haven't started in post quite yet. However, there's an awful lot that's going on. So we've already got a team in place and delighted to have colleagues at GP Fiona Lemons, who's already working as Associate Medical Director, on the pretty huge task of getting ready for a transition from what currently exists, this combination of our commissioners through the CCGs, bringing together certainly our GP colleagues, because we've got a large number of colleagues who are supporting in lots of different clinical roles, getting our secondary care providers ready who are sitting already within provider collaboratives and that sort of thing, to come together into a formal system now, and all the governance that needs to be put together to make sure that that is ready to run and deliver for our communities come the 1st of July.
That's great. And how about you, Jonathan?
Yeah, I think from a general practice perspective, there are some concerns and there's some great opportunities. So there's concern, I think, from GPs at the moment about what's happening with the CCG. So CCGs, who've been around for the past decade, and GPs have felt very connected to them, and of course they're all about to disappear. So there is concern from GPs about what's going to happen and what's going to replace them, who do they turn to. But there's some great opportunities with the ICS coming around that we can really start to integrate and work more closely across systems, both as health and care as well. And I think GPs have needing to work within their areas of place. So for us, that is areas that are geographically consistent with their local authorities, often with local hospitals working in that area as well. So if we can try to improve the communication, the engagement, the integration between general practice, our hospital consultant colleagues, social care system as well, we can start to make some real positive differences for the patients that we're serving.
Okay. And I guess this is all happening at a time of unprecedented pressure in the NHS. We're emerging out of the pandemic. Do you see that as being something to stimulate closer working, or is that more of a challenge?
I think it's both. So it's absolutely a challenge. And we're going to talk a little bit in a minute about a consensus on the primary and secondary care interface. And it's because of this demand that this document has come to be. And we'll say more about that shortly. It's a huge challenge as to how we manage the demand that's coming in at the moment. There was demand before the pandemic. It's all been a bit crazy over the course of the last couple of years, and that demand has not gone away, and if anything, has increased in recent months. And we can only really manage this if we do it as a system working together. If we try to manage the current demand as individual parts of the system, whether it be a general practice or an A&E department or the hospital or social care on their own, I don't think we'll manage that. We have to work in a different, more joined up way.
And what we've learned through the pandemic, of course, is that the ability to be agile and responsive in a time that none of us has seen in our careers, and I'm sure hope never to see again. And we've got a lot of what we call COVID keepers, you know, different ways of working, turning to technology, some remote working that has been transformative for some groups of patients, but with it, the challenge of probably further widened health inequalities. The haves and the have-nots when it comes to technology is probably being more widely exposed than it has ever been. And yet we've got to work through that, this huge elective recovery piece to be done, as well as A&E departments that have perhaps never been busier. It hits the headlines with our ambulance colleagues in really, really pressurised situations. How do we manage to work through all of that little lot when we've got a workforce who've given almost everything already? You know, we've got to, it's not about working harder, we've got to work a whole lot smarter if we're going to safely navigate for both our patients and our workforce.
Okay, so we're going to talk about the consensus document that's recently been produced around the interface between primary and secondary care, but I suppose before we get onto that, it might just be worth getting a few comments on the kind of context of where we are at the moment. So maybe, Jonathan, if I start with you. So from a primary care perspective, so I noticed, for instance, in the news this week, there's been reports of hundreds of thousands of patients who've been referred in, being sent back to GPs because of lack of capacity in hospital clinics. Is that something that you've experienced here in Cheshire and Merseyside, or...?
I think not specifically suddenly seeing huge numbers of people discharged into primary care or referrals rejected. But I think over the past couple of years, it's been at times a strained relationship between primary and secondary care. And that's not for me thinking that my secondary care colleagues aren't doing a good job. I think they're doing an amazing job. But it's been difficult. We've moved to different ways of working. So the key thing to note there is there's lots more hospital outpatient clinics that are being undertaken remotely. So people are being consulted over the phone or via video. And so that leads to potentially work being shifted. So the patient's not sat in an outpatient department. So if the consultant feels I want them to have some blood tests, they can't walk down the corridor and have the blood test there and then. So what do they do? So we've seen increased requests for GPs. Well, will you do the blood tests for this patient because they're not actually geographically located with me? And I think we were all very happy to pick that up over the course of the pandemic when we were in lockdowns. We were not wanting people to be encouraged to be travelling beyond their local areas. And so that was absolutely fair enough. But some of those behaviours have continued. And I think general practice, having seen an increased demand from their own work and patients, are thinking, well, hold on, what's going on here? We're picking up additional work that we weren't seeing before. Also, we all know that we're struggling to try to tackle the waiting times that have accumulated over the past couple of years for hospital operations and the like. And while people are sat on waiting lists, either to be seen in clinic or for their operation, they are concerned they might have become worse, or they just are unhappy at how long they've had to wait. Where do they go? And so a number of them turn up at the general practice. So even if they're not being discharged from the hospital, they're still having to come to us, or they're choosing to come to us, I should say, to ask, well, what's happening next? Can you hurry up my appointment? I'm still in pain. What can you do about my painkillers? How can you help me with my breathlessness? And these things we wouldn't necessarily even have to pick up before, when the system was running a bit more smoothly than it is now. We know why it's not running as smoothly, because of the pandemic.
So we hear a lot about capacity in primary care. So given that we're seeing more patients in a community setting than historically, and that's generally considered to be a good thing, where do we release capacity within primary care to be able to do that in the future?
I think it's really difficult, isn't it? Because we've also struggling for workforce in general practice. It's a bit of a workforce crisis. What we have seen is an increase in different kinds of staff in the community. So the traditional offer from your GP was the GP or the practice nurse, and that was it. And I think lots of people still think that's the model. So I'm either going to get an appointment with the GP or with the practice nurse. And the number of different types of roles have increased dramatically over the past couple of years. So we now have physiotherapists, we have social prescribers, we have pharmacists who can be prescribers as well, we have paramedics, and the list goes on, actually. So some of the extra demand that we're seeing can be picked up by these additional roles. Some of it still needs a GP. And it's tricky to be able to answer your question and say, this is where the capacity is going to come from. And many GPs are saying all these additional roles are great. They are certainly busy. They are seeing people. They're fulfilling a role. They might be actually meeting some previously unmet demand. So the GPs don't feel they're working any less hard because they've got all these additional staff. And actually, we need more GPs. And there's been a government commitment to increase the number of GPs over the years. We're still hoping that that's going to materialise. I'm hearing that training numbers are being filled and are increasing, so we're getting more GPs coming in at the bottom end. One of the concerns is we've got more GPs choosing to retire or retire early through the stresses of the pandemic in the past couple of years. So workforce is a big issue.
Okay. And I'm sorry.
I was going to say, from the point of view of me stepping in as the medical director, how do I want to see it work? So this is almost my vision for an ICS that works well and therefore speaks to the challenges that our GP colleagues faces. In the ideal world, if we get our system functioning how I want to see it, that will mean that we get so much better at keeping our citizens well in the first place, keeping them away from needing to see their GP. But those that do need to see their GP, it's up to us then to make sure that those pathways and routes forward are as good as they can be, so that ideally as few as need to will make their way from GPs all the way into secondary care. You know, we've got some good quality holistic interventions, but those that need us in secondary care and even specialist care, if they need us, we will be there and get on and provide that care. But then we've got to get good at safely returning them back into their communities with not just that intervention, but that all that goes with it to get them safely back, functioning, and therefore not needing to come back into the start of that cycle again. Now, that's going to be a huge task to undertake, but we've never been offered that opportunity before, that one system can manage that entire cycle of movement through healthcare and therefore influence it at every point. So it shouldn't just be Jonathan and GP colleagues that feel they're able to work differently, but through that entire cycle is where we should be looking to get it right. It's going to take time, but if we hold on to that as a way of working, it would be a great way forward. And the document that we're talking about today is perhaps one of the first steps in making that cycle work very much more smoothly for our patients.
Okay, well, that gives me a nice segue, I suppose, into the document. So I've had a look at the document this morning. It's all very common sense. There's nothing in there that I would disagree with. I suppose I might ask the obvious question, though, is why has it become necessary that we need to write down this kind of thing now? Is it not just how we should be behaving as fellow professionals? What would you say to that?
It is. And there's a lot of this stuff that goes on extremely well already. But it's an opportunity for us, as we are getting launched into an integrated system, to bring together our clinical colleagues to start to integrate. And for really good, productive conversations, and if you want to develop more sophisticated pathways, a great place to start is to say, well, are there a set of principles that we will always use to underpin the way we work, the way we interact, the way we behave, what we can expect of each other in our professional behaviours and responsibilities for different aspects of that patient's care? And if we agree those, that means we can set designing a whole series of pathways for our patients, confident that they should work in a way that can be reproduced, relied upon, is transparent, is agreed, and allows us to start to forge those very much closer and therefore more meaningful working relationships.
Yeah, I would agree. And why do we need it is, unfortunately, because we're not all following these principles all of the time. And actually, I think that when you're feeling stressed and the demand is there and you're working long hours, I think that's the times when you need to remind yourself to work in an appropriate way. And it becomes sometimes easier to not. And so, you know, have I, hand on heart, adhered to these principles as a GP all the time? No, I've not. Have I sent in perhaps not the best referrals every now and again, or not communicated what I was intending? Absolutely. And so it's trying to then sort of specify a few things and be clear about this is what we would expect you to do. And the reason it's important is that it's absolutely here that patients can fall through the gaps. So when you're passing somebody from one part of the system to another part of the system, patients can suddenly find that they're tripping up over that gap and they get lost. And to your earlier point about how can we manage some of this excess demand, how can we increase capacity? Well, actually, if we can get the right things done at the right time, it's quicker, more efficient. We're not passing work around the system. Patients don't fall through those gaps, and that tends to result in a lower levels of demand. So an example would be a patient goes to have surgery, either it's planned or they've had an emergency situation, and they get told by the surgeon, you now need to have, I think, probably 3 months off work. But rather than giving them a sick note, they say, go to your GP for the note, which then creates an appointment with me that actually, if they'd just given the note in hospital, that wouldn't be required at all. And a time when we're also being told as GPs, you know, well, make sure you're seeing people and you're accessible, avoid them going to A&E. Well, you've just used an appointment that otherwise could have been given for somebody with an emergency problem by doing a fit note that could have been done elsewhere. So, and those kind of things, unfortunately, are still happening. Now, part of this, I think, is myth busting. It's getting the systems right. And I don't know why that sick note wasn't done. Either the person doing it felt that they couldn't do it, or they didn't have the sick note pad on the ward when they came to do it. There's all kinds of reasons why it might not have been done. And this is trying to address that and not pointing fingers, not blaming, but saying, let's try and get this right.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, a lot of that clearly resonates with me. I suppose we should give Rowan a chance to kind of think about from a secondary care perspective. I'm sure there's other frustrations. So in much the same way, I think that, you know, GPs get sometimes a bit frustrated with that kind of admin burden. Are there similar examples from the document maybe that I think as GPs we could do to help you and your colleagues in secondary care?
I think the real challenge that's come along is because there's a lot of stuff that isn't necessarily being seen face to face. What might sound spot on down the phone, when the patient then makes their way either into an urgent slot, maybe in a clinic, or indeed are directed to the A&E department, there are times that there's a subset of those patients that you think, oh, did they really need to come and be here? And would that have been handled differently had they had the opportunity to be seen face to face? And that, again, that comes back to the myth busting, isn't it? That the most commonly quoted, and it's my favourite journal, the British Journal of Anecdotal Medicine, where everybody will say, well, I've certainly had a patient and, you know, that was completely wrong and that, you know, all of our GPs are doing this. Well, no, hang on just a minute. So, yes, there are always going to be those water cooler conversations about, oh, you won't believe what I've had through the doors. OK, so this then looks to bring almost that pledge that comes from both sides, that compromise of, you know, the very best of behaviours to minimise those sorts of frustrations coming through. And when we start to, you know, everybody steps up to that pledge that comes from the document, that's when we start to get it right. And you feel the positive benefits of it for your patients and for your professional lives. And then you start to step forward together.
And just, I think if we think that we're probably going to see fewer patients face to face, moving forward, just because I think there's many opportunities that we've seen through the course of the pandemic, how we can work differently and sometimes more efficiently. But again, in terms of that interface piece, does the fact that we will see more patients remotely, does that give us particular challenges for the interface? I suppose that's a question to either of you, really.
I guess what many of us are struck by is this wonderfully rounded number that 25% should be heading out into either remote or, you know, patient-initiated follow-up type things. And you think, I'd love to see the piece of work that generated that perfectly round number. And the reality is it will suit some specialties more than others. Specialising in skin cancer, gosh, it's essential that we climb over our patients every 3 months with a dermatoscope to make sure there isn't something unexpected. The laying on of hands remains probably one of the most ancient and yet still essential parts of medicine. So we've got to harness the technology to choose the right patients that this will work for. And I think that's going to be an evolution and a journey, because not every patient has read the textbook as to how their disease and pathology should play out, not surprisingly, to how we respond to that. So it's going to be a tricky one.
Yeah, I agree. And I think we are learning as we go with this. And we, you know, a couple of years ago, we were essentially told, you know, don't bring people into the surgery unless you absolutely have to. We were in phase one, weren't we, of the wave one of the pandemic. And we've evolved from there. And different GPs will have different thresholds as to who they will bring in. And the key challenge, isn't it, just as Rowan has said, is how do we identify the patients that really do need to be seen? And the interesting thing is, for lots of my patients, they appear to be very happy to have a phone consultation. It suits their lifestyle. They don't have to make their way to the centre. Often, it's only at the end when you have a conversation and you realise actually they're not in the town that I'm working in. They're at work in Manchester, or they're on holiday somewhere, and they can still have that consultation with their GP. And so for many, it works really well. And we sometimes find when I'm deciding I want to see you face to face, can you come in? And they would rather not, you know. Oh, actually, no, I can't come in. Can we make it another time? I would prefer to do that remotely. But as you say, the challenge, identifying those that need to be seen and getting that done in the right way, may it cause more problems seeing people remotely? Yes, it may, and that's the challenge. How do you identify those where it's appropriate to do so?
Yeah. So here's the thing. I think that the document lays out how you would expect clinicians to work with each other under ideal circumstances. But again, going back to your water cooler conversation, it's evident that from time to time, things do fall down. So, and this is, I think, difficult to answer, but how do you know that this report is going to have an impact? Is there a way you can measure its effectiveness? How can we take the temperature of the kind of culture between primary, secondary care within the region in the future? Any ideas about that?
I think that's going to come down to the leaders that we have both at place and then within the system, because of course we've got, you know, a whole series of forums that exist out there. So we've got the provider collaboratives, who are very good at being the voice of the experience of secondary care. We've got place that will have medical leadership at place, our primary care networks. There's a whole series of forums where that can be voiced. Should we do something more formal to measure that temperature? You know what? It would be a great place to get to. That mechanism doesn't fully exist at the minute. Do I, as an academic, like the idea of a wraparound of a project that produces something really meaningful like that? Oh, I really do, because that's how you get things more widely adopted and it gets real traction, is when you evidence, you know, the outcome of an intervention. It mattered to us more that we got something out there, that we started to describe that improved working relationship, rather than get caught up in how we might measure that. I'd love to see it come down the way, though, certainly.
Yeah, I think, yeah, academic evaluation of this would be fantastic, wouldn't it? And fascinating piece of work to do. That's me, not as an academic GP, but very, very open to somebody doing that or working with someone to do that. We'd be looking, wouldn't we, to just, it's a soft thing, but does the noise start to settle down? There's a lot of noise in the system. There's a lot of disgruntlement, certainly from a GP that you hear. I'm sure the same is true. It's the water cooler conversation, as you said before. And it would be good to see that noise die down. The challenge then is that people don't notice because you're not recording it. And so actually you don't notice when something isn't there anymore. And so when people stop talking about this being an issue, that will be our success. That's really, really hard to measure. I think it is an excellent document to start off on our journey as an ICS. And I think it sets the tone really well to say we are now going to work together on this. Part of the where this came from was a sense that we were not quite understanding each other in primary and secondary care. You know, I've not worked in hospitals for longer than I might like to mention. Many of my hospital colleagues have never worked in general practice because they were never required to do so as part of their training. And so how would we expect to understand each other and how things work? You know, I've been out and spent a day with the acute physicians at my local hospital, and it was eye-opening because the way the junior doctors are working now is so different to how I worked in hospital, dare I say, 25 years ago. And without going and seeing it for myself, I wouldn't understand that. And we need to understand each other. We need to understand that we are all in it together, and that demands that we're facing and the challenges of our work is not because one part of the system is trying to make it more difficult for another part of the system. We're all trying our very best for our patients. This document, I think, just helps us to do that in a better way than perhaps we have been going forwards, and gives us some a framework and some principles to be working to, which I think is going to be really good.
And crucially, because we are going to now say, what does a better pathway look like for the patient? To have agreed the way we lay out those slabs, who's responsible for which one, makes, I'm hoping, very much more straightforward to do something consistently that we can, you know, some good architecture that you can come back to time and time again, because you know who's going to manage medication at which end, responsible for checking the result of a test at which point in the patient journey, and to be able to rely on each other because you know exactly who's responsible for what. And when you can rely and trust, that's when, as I've said before, we step forward together. That's better for patients.
And there are some things in here that I think that are very specifically help patients. So there's a bit in here about, so you asked Rowan earlier, you know, what could GPs do that's better? One of the bits in the document is, if I'm referring somebody that I know or I suspect is going to need an operation, you know, and sometimes that's what I'll be doing. They've got a hernia, they're going to need it repaired. If I know that I'm referring them for that, they've also got a bit of a weight. I know they've got diabetes or they've got high blood pressure. Why would I not be making sure that their diabetes was as well controlled as it could be between now and when they have their operation? Because actually what we see is people turning up to the preoperative assessment and being turned away because their diabetes isn't well enough controlled or their blood pressure is too high. Go away and get that sorted out and then we'll do your operation. Now that is a real pain in the neck for the patient. Literally might be a pain if they're waiting for an operation for something that's causing them pain. So why would we not try and do those things in advance? Now, for any GPs listening who are throwing their arms up in the air now, I don't think this is asking you to do the job of the pre-op clinic. I think this is you're asking to do the job as a GP. We should be managing long-term conditions. So if you know this is going to be an issue in 9 months' time, why would you not work with the patient and empower the patient as well to do what they can to be operation fit and operation ready? And that's just one example in the document that I think would make a specific improvement to patient care.
Certainly from our side in secondary care, in exactly the same way, when said patient has got through their care and all the rest of it, and we're returning them to their GP practice, perhaps they've come in with acute kidney injury, and we then say, and please follow up on their U's and E's. Well, hang on, at what point are we asking our GPs to do the job of secondary care? Far more powerful would be, I need the U's and E's checking every 2 weeks, and if they hit these particular specific criteria, we'll pick them up further within the renal team again. So, and that's where we've just described a pathway, but it needs both sides to go, I'm up for doing that pathway and will take responsibility for, you know, these different steps, all of a sudden our jobs start to get easier.
Yeah, and I think just to add to that, one of the challenges of this document is how we make it into a living document. And I can have this conversation with Rowan. I'm a GP partner. Rowan's a consultant, medical director, in fact. Actually, who's writing the discharge summaries and saying, follow up the U's and E's? It's quite possibly the junior doctor. So one of the challenges, I think, is how we make this document, these principles, known and understood and used by all of the workforce, whether it be GP trainee in practice, whether it be the junior doctor, whether it be the advanced nurse practitioner in clinic. How do we get this document out there? And that's one of the advantages of talking to you today, Phil, of course, is we want to get the news of this out there. And thank you for this podcast that can help to do that. But we need to get it out there far and wide and have those local conversations about what does this mean. So I live, work in Cheshire, so I want there to be conversations between, I don't know whether it was me or not, but my fellow GPs and the consultants and the juniors at Mid-Cheshire Hospitals, because I want these processes to be working for us locally and make it real there. And the same should be happening around Cheshire and Merseyside.
And we've already started conversations from St Helens and Knowsley with our St Helens GPs around renal pathways, so that we're getting patients who are out living with chronic renal disease to say, well, at what point should a consultant be intervening for you? Let's actually put some clear markers in the sand, because that way we start to tackle inequity of services. You know, why is it that one GP might be sending a whole bunch of patients through and someone else is struggling with it and not sure when to refer them? Strengthening the pathways, consistent care for all, that everybody knows the part that they play in it. So it feels the right time, the right approach. There's a need for it. You know, there, as I say, those water cooler things, our experience in ED is Jonathan may have sorted out 99 of the patients coming through, but the one that couldn't get through on the phone and actually is really poorly and does make it all the way to A&E, and our colleagues are left going, well, what I've got in front of me is someone that the system has not worked for them. They have been let down. Okay, it's our system now. And certainly it's the job of the medical leadership in there to reach out to all of our stakeholders. And it's been superb to work with Jonathan, who's brought this forward and said, okay, let's bring it to life. Let's embed it. Let's live it. Let's use it to underpin the way we work together. Let's get on and do this together.
Well, we can carry this conversation on offline, but sadly we've come to the end of our time here on the podcast. If you're listening and you haven't read the document, it's called The Consensus on the Primary and Secondary Care Interface. It's published on the ICS website, and we'll also put a link in to our website. Also, I definitely commend it to any clinicians who are listening. Just remains for me to thank our guests today, to Jonathan and to Rowan, for your hard work, which I think this is an excellent start, as you say, and very much hope we can continue to work on this in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Phil.
Thank you to our guests, Professor Rowan Pritchard-Jones and Dr. Jonathan Griffiths, and to host Dr. Phil Jennings. Do check out the new protocol on primary and secondary care interface. There's a link in the podcast notes. Thank you for listening.